Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Upward Bound programs face budget cuts.
I was accepted into this wonderful program that was going to offer me opportunities.
There's concern about an increase in black lung disease cases.
If they really got serious with trying to protect coal miners from black lung and what have you, they would do it.
A look at soot as pollution and as art.
They're both stunning and somewhat horrifying. And as an artist, I'm interested in this conflict of beauty.
And science teachers will benefit from a new online documentary.
Because essentially science is fun. Science is exploration. Science is adventure.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by the Augusta Heritage Center of Davis and Elkins College, presenting summer workshops in traditional music, dance, and crafts in Elkins, West Virginia. Details at augustaheritagecenter.org.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A program that helps children climb out of poverty is one of many victims of sequestration, those across-the-board federal budget cuts. Upward Bound budgets across the country were cut 5.3% this past week. In West Virginia, this means fewer students will be accepted into the program. As West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly reports, one former participant remains hopeful that the program will continue to help children looking to go to college.
I grew up in a little town called Twin Branch, up in a holler.
Sabrina Schrader remembers having friendly neighbors as a child. Schrader says she grew up poor in a home filled with domestic violence.
I have many memories of running from my father. He beat my mother many times, terribly, over and over again. He blamed her for everything. She couldn't do anything right. And my mom tried to protect us because she told me that when I heard my dad start fighting with her, to run. And we did. I have three younger siblings, and so many times I would hear my dad hitting my mom, and I would gather my three younger siblings, and we would climb out the window. And we would just run. So when you're talking about families living in poverty, you have to realize that many times families are doing the best they can with what they know how.
Schrader says she and her siblings remained isolated. Permission to visit other homes or other places was rare. Violence was all she knew, so she thought of it as a regular or accepted way of living, until she says she was accepted into the Upward Bound program in the ninth grade.
I was accepted into this wonderful program that was going to offer me opportunities such as going to Concord University during the summer for 6 weeks to take classes. I had not ever been to a college, and it seemed that going to college was so impossible for someone who came from coming from a family where my dad didn't even graduate eighth grade, and my mom ended up having to quit high school because she got pregnant with me.
While in the sixth grade, Schrader met Pamela McPeak. McPeak is the director and coordinator of the Upward Bound programs at Concord University.
It's like a life raft for a drowning victim. I see that where students, they want to succeed or to be saved, and they don't know where to receive this.
Upward Bound is part of the TRIO program created in 1964 under President Lyndon B. Johnson and his administration's War on Poverty. It's funded through competitive grants from the U.S. Department of Education. Students who live in households with low income or who would be the first generation college graduates qualify.
We have students that come from abused families, foster care. We have students that have parents that are in the prison system. Our students come from Southern West Virginia, which encompasses all sorts of different challenges for them.
McPeak oversees services for five counties, including Greenbrier, Monroe, Summers, Mercer, and McDowell. She says the program focuses on helping students to have the skills necessary to complete a four-year college degree and beyond. Upward Bound representatives track students, follow up with calls, check copies of their grades, help to fill out FAFSA forms, and other duties as needed, like when Sabrina Schrader was in a car accident at the age of 17. Schrader sustained traumatic brain injury and was fighting for her life.
Upward Bound teaches students that anything is possible. And even though the doctors were telling me that I wouldn't walk again, I knew if I wanted to walk and God would let me, that I would walk again, and I did.
Sabrina is very determined and maybe a little bit stubborn too, because if you tell her she can't do something, she'll definitely prove you wrong. She has such a strong sense of herself now where she has the confidence necessary to take her throughout her life, to continue being a wonderful employee, but to also take charge of her life and help the students that she works with now, help them to be successful as well.
Schrader graduated from college and is now enrolled in the Master of Social Work program at Concord. She's currently employed as the program assistant for the Upward Bound program based at Concord. And McPeak is now Schrader's boss.
It just warms my heart to see what she has become from a six-year-old, being an abused little girl, to overcoming a severe car wreck and family problems to become the strong, successful female that she is. We're very proud of what she has accomplished and also our part with the Upward Bound program in her life.
Last year, the program worked directly with about 50 students. McPeak says sequestration has cut the budget more than 5%, which translates to about 10 students that will not get a chance to take part.
And without these Upward Bound programs, these children are likely to set up to fail and to continue living in poverty the rest of their lives.
Still, Schrader says she's looking forward to focusing on throwing a raft to the remaining Upward Bound students. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Athens.
West Virginia has for many years struggled with how to keep young people from leaving the state to find jobs. This past week in Charleston, the Bright Economic Future for the Mountain State Conference outlined many of the challenges faced by the state's economy. But as West Virginia Public Radio's Dave Mistich reports, many entrepreneurs, policy experts, and grassroots organizations see plenty of opportunity.
While the Union of Concerned Scientists usually focuses on issues related to climate change and renewable energy, West Virginia native and UCS fellow Jeremy Richardson noticed the need to apply those issues to the economy and helped organize the Bright Economic Future Conference.
What I'm learning is that people really are interested in having this conversation about what our future looks like. And I think that we see really strong support for the idea of diversifying the economy, that is creating more opportunities for people here.
West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy Executive Director Ted Bettner says a diverse, healthy economy ultimately comes down to a healthy and financially stable workforce. But, he says, the state has struggled with that in recent decades.
Back in the late 70s, there was a time when middle-class families were faring pretty well, or wages were a little higher, more people had benefits, you could raise a whole family just on one income, and those times have dramatically changed. Now you need both people in the workforce, and you're earning less, you're working more hours, and at the same time, you're unable to afford some really basic expenses like health care.
During a panel focused on the potential of the state moving forward, Kent Spellman of the West Virginia Community Development Hub noted that his organization believes that working with small communities is the key to improving the economic picture.
We really believe, frankly, that economic transition, this is a great group of people, but for it to work, we have to get out in our communities and we have to listen. The Hub in its work with these small rural communities, and we mostly work with smaller rural communities, focuses on wealth creation, not job creation. We want to see communities create opportunities, economic opportunities that are locally based, place-based, that keep the wealth in the community. And so we want to look at what makes a healthy community, what are those capitals that make a healthier community, and we want to address all of them.
Both Richardson and Bettner echoed Spellman's call for a local push for the diversification of the state's economy. Richardson says that means it's up to each community to play a part in deciding how they can contribute to the state's economic future.
I think it depends on where you are. You know, we were just listening to one of the commissioners of Fayette County who was talking about with the wonderful opportunities that they've taken advantage of there and the tourism industry that's growing. You know, I know people in Williamson who are doing some really amazing work on, you know, trying to retrain people to make buildings more efficient and install solar panels. And, you know, this is the heart of the billion-dollar coal fields, right? So I think it depends on your location to some extent. I think that where, you know, the message that I'm trying to get out there is that, you know, we have to expand people's idea of what's even possible.
Other presentations at the conference included Richardson's discussion of sustainable economic development, a lecture from Bettner on the proposed State Future Fund, and a screening and discussion of the interactive film Hollow, directed by McDowell County native Elaine McMillian. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
A U.S. Navy vessel that was used in the Allied invasion of Normandy during World War II is now docked at the port of Ashland, Kentucky. The USS LST-325 is an amphibious craft that ferried tanks to the shores of Omaha Beach on June 6, 1944. Sue Dowdy is director of the Ashland-Boyd County Visitors and Convention Bureau. She says the boat is the last of its kind.
I think it's pretty miraculous, too. It's the only surviving one of that kind of ship after they had built over 1,000, and this is the only one that survived. It's pretty incredible.
15,000 visitors toured the ship during its last stop in Charleston, West Virginia. The vessel's moored in Ashland through Monday. Dowdy says public tours take place between 9 and 5. Tuesday, it sets sail for Madison, Indiana, where it will dock September 12th to the 15th. Then it heads to Owensboro, Kentucky, the 19th through the 22nd. The ship is operated by the nonprofit LST Memorial Incorporated. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A judge has temporarily halted work at a surface mine in eastern Kentucky. As Kentucky Public Radio's Erica Peterson reports, environmental groups are appealing a federal court decision to let the project move forward.
Environmental groups, including Kentuckians for the Commonwealth and Earth Justice, are appealing last month's decision that the Army Corps of Engineers acted appropriately when it permitted a mine in eastern Kentucky. The groups had sued the Corps for issuing the permit, despite a growing body of evidence that suggests surface mining is associated with numerous human health effects. Jennifer Chavez is an attorney for Earth Justice.
The science is becoming clearer and clearer every day, and we think that it's time for the Corps to go ahead and take responsibility for those impacts and at least consider them before issuing permits for mining in streams.
The environmental groups are appealing the decision to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. A judge granted a temporary injunction at the mine to stop work, but will decide soon whether to grant a longer injunction. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
One side effect of coal mining is black lung disease. Over the decades, great gains have been made in reducing black lung, but recently there's been an uptick in the sometimes fatal condition. WEKU's Stu Johnson explains.
50 years ago, Central Appalachian Education and Research Center Director Wayne Sanderson says about a third of all miners contracted black lung. Today, the potentially deadly disease afflicts about 4 to 5% of miners, and Sanderson says that number's climbing.
One of the big worries we have is that with the efficiency of the mining techniques and the coal preparation plants, that the mines are actually beginning to mine more rock rather than coal, and that rock will contain crystalline silica, which is highly damaging to the lungs. It's highly toxic to lung tissue.
That resurgence was the topic of a recent symposium in Lexington. Jay Collinette is a senior scientist with the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. Collinette says a study due out in a couple of months focuses on extending methods of suppressing coal and rock dust with water.
The scrubber had a major impact, statistically significant impact, in reducing the dust levels downwind of the continuous miner. So if you have miners working downwind, running a roof bolting machine, for example, the use of the scrubber would have a advantageous impact on their dust exposures.
Stanley Sergel is a retired miner from Harlan County with more than four decades of experience. In protecting miners, Sturgill says it still comes down to consistent enforcement and adherence to rules.
If they really got serious with trying to protect coal miners from black lung and what have you, they would do it.
Sturgill claims some coal companies only follow federal guidelines and standards when government inspectors are on site. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
Meanwhile, West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller continues his fight to reduce the number of black lung cases, a new policy that would cut in half the amount of permissible coal dust in underground mines is making its way through federal agencies in the form of proposed rule and regulation changes. The same stricter standards are proposed in legislation that Rockefeller introduced this summer. As West Virginia Public Radio's Suzanne Higgins reports, Rockefeller conducted a roundtable discussion about black lung in Bluefield.
Senator Jay Rockefeller met with coal miners, healthcare professionals, and other advocates to discuss the increasing cases of black lung disease, citing that more than 2,000 West Virginia miners have died of black lung over the last decade.
I think the most important thing I want to say is that black lung is totally preventable. And to do that, we're going to have to change our habits in West Virginia. We're going to have to change either our rules and regulations from the federal government or our laws. And if the first doesn't happen, I'm prepared to try to do the second.
The standard has been 2 milligrams of respirable or breathable coal dust per cubic meter of air. Anita Wolf is coordinator for the Coal Workers Health Surveillance Program with the National Institute for Occupational Health and Safety, known as NIOSH. The federal agency has pushed to cut those standards in half for about 25 years. Wolf said yesterday it's clear that the current enforcement standards are not protecting human health.
With the technology that we have and what we know about the disease, it shouldn't be happening. And it definitely should not be happening to the younger miners we're seeing, and at the rates that we're starting to see again, because we are seeing a rise in the numbers of disease. We're seeing miners, I think our youngest miner is 39 years old, that has black lung disease. We're seeing miners that go from beginning stages of black lung disease to the end stage of disease, progressive massive fibrosis, at a very accelerated rate, like we've never seen before. It's caused by the inhalation of too much dust. It's not rocket science. Miners are being exposed to too much dust, or they wouldn't be getting sick.
Third-generation coal miner Vernon Bailey, who has black lung, worked underground in Keystone for 35 years.
How many times do you hear a person come around tell you that if we don't load coal, we're going to have to shut this mines down? They got to make money. So you, a coal miner, we'll take a chance or two to satisfy the company getting the coal out.
Dr. Dan Doyle, director of the New River Health Center, a black lung clinic in Fayette County.
If the longwall machine is going to be destroyed by dust, they'll control the dust because it costs them hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to replace it. But it's easy to replace people. We all know people are lined up to work in the mines. What kind of a society are we? Do we sacrifice human lives for corporate profits, or do we have certain standards that people can be safe in their jobs and can survive their jobs?
85-year-old Donald Rasmussen, a pioneer in black lung disease diagnosis and treatment, said the Black Lung Benefits Program is terribly flawed.
If I see a miner whom I believe has disabling lung disease due to mine dust exposure, I know it's going to be a long time before or if he receives benefits. And that's frustrating. That's frustrating.
District Director of the Federal Black Lung Program, Rick Hanna.
It's a tough program. Our job is to be the neutral party in this process. Unfortunately, the way the law is written, it's an adversarial process where you have a coal operator trying to defend and you have a claimant trying to establish the eligibility. But we try to do the best we can with the regulations and what we're permitted to do under the regs and the law.
Am I right in suggesting that about 80% of the black lung claims that come to you are turned down?
I believe our approval rate is right around 15%. So it would be like 85% of the claims that we get, we are denied.
And why would that be, Rick?
Well, you have to be totally disabled due to the respiratory condition, and you have to have black lung. A lot of our miners, they'll come in and they will have co-workers pneumoconiosis or black lung, but they won't meet the regulatory levels of total disability due to a respiratory condition, and they'll be denied. Now, the good thing about the black lung regulations for miners is that they can refile. It's a progressive disease, and it gets worse over time, so they can come back and refile time and time again.
But then they have to have a lawyer, and lawyers cost. And so the coal companies have the best paid lawyers. That doesn't seem quite fair, does it?
Rockefeller introduced the Black Lung Health Improvements Act of 2013 last month, seeking to cut permissible dust and addressing the rejection rate of black lung benefits. But if the allowable dust levels aren't lowered through legislation, they may be adopted by the Obama administration. Just last week, the standards that have been supported by NIOSH for 25 years were approved by the Department of Labor and are now in the Office of Management and Budget. Rockefeller says the last stop before possible adoption. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Bluefield.
Burning coal for fuel creates soot, and for a long time, scientists have known that breathing in soot from vehicles and power plants is bad for us. But the soot itself might not be the problem, at least not entirely. Scientists have found that particles live a secret life once released into the atmosphere, picking up toxic gases and other hitchhikers before making their way into our lungs. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more.
To study air pollution, sometimes you have to go to some really weird places.
So, those are the cars.
Daniel Tachik is standing inside the Fort Pitt Tunnel in Pittsburgh. We're actually one floor above I-376, which courses through the tunnel. We're peering down at the highway through these narrow ventilation slots. And yeah, I'm pretty sure the slot's big enough for me to fall through.
And I'll get really close to the exit of the tunnel. Oh boy, like right there. A semi just drove by and it was like 3 feet from our heads.
This strange place is Tachik's temporary laboratory. He's a graduate student at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. He wants to know not just what's in the exhaust, but what it'll look like in a few days. He runs the exhaust through a machine that's like one of those software programs that tells you what you'll look like in the future.
We're taking these particles and we're aging them. We're aging them by 4 days. So 4 days is a pretty significant chunk of its life. It's like we're catching at it like in its mid-20s, maybe.
For a long time, scientists thought that the soot coming out of a tailpipe was basically unchanged from the time it was created inside an engine to the time that we breathed it in. But in the last few decades, they found that soot and other small particles change pretty radically while they're in the air. Harvey Jeffries is a retired chemist at the University of North Carolina who studied these particles.
They're really teeny fine particles.
He says for decades, scientists have known that the smallest of these particles were the worst for us, probably because they could slip through our natural defense systems and end up deep in our lungs. So they started studying them, and what they found was unexpected.
The mass of these things changed over time, and in fact, you gained mass.
These tiny particles got bigger after spending a few days in the atmosphere, and there was more.
But they began to find it was gooey. It was sticky.
That's right. The particles were growing and getting gooey.
And as they examined it more and more, they began to figure out this is a kind of complicated organic soup.
What was happening? In a word, oxygen. It makes up about 20% of our atmosphere, and a lot of times this oxygen forms something called a hydroxyl radical. What's this? It's basically a water molecule that's missing one hydrogen atom, so it's really jonesing for an extra hydrogen. It turns out the atmosphere has lots of hydrogen available, attached to molecules that are just sort of hanging around. And a lot of times, these molecules come from stuff that we create, like exhaust from buses and cars, weed whackers, and those fumes from spray paint cans. With the help of a little sunlight, the hydroxyl radical can go to work on these molecules, says Carnegie Mellon's Neil Donahue, an atmospheric chemist.
It's just ravenous. So it sees all these hydrogens on these very big molecules. It just starts ripping them off here, there, and everywhere.
And when it does that, it makes a new substance that's heavier and goopier. This new substance has a name. It's called secondary organic aerosol. And it wants to condense, much like how steam from a shower condenses onto a bathroom mirror. Instead of a mirror, it uses particles in the air, like a piece of soot. This process happens quickly. After a few days, there can be hundreds of thousands of different chemical compounds stuck to a particle, many of them made by humans. But in recent years, scientists have found one surprising source for the goop that hangs onto particles.
What we're going to do is we're going to open a bottle of alpha pinene. So this is the material that's coming out of pine trees.
Rich Kamens is a professor of environmental science at the University of North Carolina. He's outside a small lab demonstrating how trees, yeah, trees, contribute to particle pollution. In his hand is a small bottle of clear liquid. Now, you can't smell this on the radio, but trust me, the bottle gives off that pine tree smell. It's actually a liquid version of a gas that the trees emit into the atmosphere. Kamens has a drop of the pine tree liquid placed in a chamber in a small greenhouse. Then he runs a souped-up hairdryer over it to simulate what would happen to the tree's chemicals in the sun. Under the right conditions, the pine tree chemical will stick onto a piece of soot or even make new particles of its own. And that's exactly what Kamens sees when he looks at a screen to see how many particles have been created.
We're seeing this initial burst of particles in the very, very smallest sizes. Now, all of the sizes that we're measuring, especially the ones above 100 nanometers, are going to penetrate deep into our lungs.
So does that mean trees are big sources of air pollution? Kamens says, not exactly.
Before people, the atmosphere was fine.
But when tree emissions combine with human-made sources, like from burning fossil fuels, that's when you get a problem. The longer these particles stay in the air, the more pollution they pick up. Here's Harvey Jeffries again.
So the particle is not itself such a toxin as it is, in our view, a carrier of toxicity, and that toxicity is being created in the atmosphere.
The atmosphere itself is dirty. Scientists want to know what's the best way to keep it clean. They think by doing this, we can prevent the particles already in the atmosphere from becoming worse for us by the time we breathe them in. Maybe someday soon, the second life of a soot particle won't be so secret anymore. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Soot as art? If you could take a snapshot of all the seemingly invisible stuff floating in the air, what would it look like? That's the question asked by a new art project called Portraits of Air. As the Allegheny Front's Michelle Pfeiffer reports, framed air filters are being hung in offices, on porches, and in other nooks and crannies all over Pittsburgh.
The balcony behind Ben Weaver's office in Pittsburgh overlooks an alley. You can hear the hum of a few air conditioning units and the traffic on a nearby street. Weaver describes the space as, quote, on the business end of a cluster of bordering storefronts.
It's a couple blocks from a few restaurants, as well as a furniture store and some general light industrial use, and we get a lot of trucks that kind of come down the alley. It's not the nicest place to hang out.
Still, when the office gets hectic, the staff meets on the balcony. On nice days, they grill out. Weaver works for a nonprofit called Pittsburgh Cares, which supports volunteering in the city. About 9 months from now, the small white air filter hung on the balcony with magnets will give the staff a rough idea of what they're breathing out there, like it or not.
The back of our building is corrugated metal, so it actually sticks pretty well.
The filter is one of about 100 distributed throughout the Pittsburgh region by Detroit artist Susan Gothel Campbell. Her project, Portraits of Air, seeks to make visible the issue of air quality in Pittsburgh. It'll culminate next summer with a gallery exhibit downtown.
As a visual artist, I have always been fascinated with the sky.
It all began with Campbell traveling around Michigan and taking photos of the storms coming in over the Great Lakes. Then she grew fascinated with the industrial plumes and the discoloration of the Detroit sky in summertime.
They're both stunning and somewhat horrifying. And as an artist, I'm interested in this conflict of beauty.
She documented what she describes as a yellowish haze over the specific corner of Detroit that houses the auto industry. She thought it was strange and beautiful, and she wondered,
how do I bring this back to the public? How do I get people to pay more attention to the air?
This summer, she launched Portraits of Air Pittsburgh, a new installation of her air filter art. She's undertaken similar projects internationally over the past 4 years. At the Three Rivers Arts Festival, held downtown in June, passersby picked up air filters to install around their homes or workplaces in spots they felt might be susceptible to poor air, a kitchen window, a parking garage.
One person put their filter on the front porch on the back of a metal chair, and they made the comment that this is where they relax, and they were wondering if it was okay to be relaxing there.
Over the course of 9 months, the filters will collect airborne particulates, smoke from the stove, particles from car fumes, or simply smudges of dust. It's not a scientific measurement. Campbell's project is more about triggering thoughts and conversation.
Sometimes we look to institutions or government to say, you know, this is where the air is dirty. I think we have a lot of information as a public that we can bring to the table.
Though the air in Pittsburgh has improved over the past decade, it's still ranked by the American Lung Association as among the most polluted air in the U.S. in terms of both ozone and particle pollution. Next summer, as part of the 2014 Three Rivers Arts Festival, the filters dotting people's porches, living rooms, and elsewhere around the city will be tacked to the walls of an art gallery downtown. By then, many will show a patina of gray or even orange. Campbell says the exhibition will be equal parts about the disconcerting beauty of these colors and the discussions about how they came to be. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Janelle Pfeiffer.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. West Virginia will be one of the states featured in a new education project created by Earth Echo International that focuses on the Chesapeake Bay. The bay is one of many bodies of water across the globe that have aquatic dead zones, or areas that because of pollution runoff don't have enough oxygen to support marine life. Earth Echo is launching a new multi-year expedition program that will focus each year on an environmental problem. Co-founder Philippe Cousteau says the first Earth Echo expedition hopes to educate middle and high school students about factors that contribute to the bay's dead zones.
The whole idea is to leverage the story of the Chesapeake Bay and dead zones to create science curriculum for 21st century learners that brings science learning and STEM education alive for kids in the classroom through the sense of a whole journey and adventure through the Chesapeake Bay and helping them understand not only the problems that we face, but the solutions as well.
Cousteau says a film crew will record the adventure as he visits communities in the Chesapeake Bay watershed for a documentary that will be presented in 6 to 10 minute segments. The documentary will be offered online with other material like games, lesson guides, action guides, and webinars that teachers can use in their classrooms.
You know, what's so wonderful is that new technology offers us terrific tools to reach out and bring education alive in the classroom for today's 21st century learners. I mean, the only place that many kids still use, you know, big old dusty books to learn is in the classroom. And outside of that, they're using technology, interacting with video and media. And it's important that we provide those resources for them in the classroom as well. And
so it sounds like you're going to be providing tools for particular lessons that meet curriculum standards. What kinds of lessons are you giving them?
So that's a great question. And you know, we spent a lot of time over the last few years refining our work. For us, it's about helping to reinforce everything from basic chemistry and biology concepts in the classroom to helping teachers teach things like the water cycle, carbon cycle, issues around food chains, biodiversity, many of these are just basic science principles that are taught in the classroom.
Cousteau says everything will be offered online for free and is designed to help teachers do their job, as well as encourage students to use the science knowledge they gain to take action and solve problems in their communities.
Because essentially, science is fun. Science is exploration. Science is adventure. Science is, you know, poking a stick at something and seeing what happens. And that sense of inquiry is sometimes lost in when you're looking at big old textbooks in the classroom.
Earth Echo will also give mini grants to teachers and students who develop projects that address environmental problems. Earth Echo plans to launch the Expeditions program on its new website October 10th. The current exhibit at the Kentucky Folk Arts Center at Morehead State University showcases paintings and drawings by an artist known for portraits, landscapes, and scenes of everyday life in eastern Kentucky. Kentucky Public Radio's Paul Hitchcock has the story.
This painting is titled Rat Row, Old Neon, and it shows the town of Neon at its heyday of prosperity. It shows Neon back in the 1920s. There's just a lot going on. The railroad runs through town. This is a snapshot of that world in a different time. Neon today looks nothing like this.
Adrian Swain, artistic director of the Kentucky Folk Arts Center at Morehead State University, describing one of the paintings by David Lucas. The exhibit features more than 80 drawings and paintings by the Kentucky artist, spanning a period from 1976 through 2013. The majority of the artwork was created during the 1980s and early 90s and features images of everyday life in eastern Kentucky. Adrian Swain says the style and technique of David Lucas is well known throughout the folk art community.
He's got a wonderful sense of design and form. Some of the things that really particularly intrigue me are the paintings where he combines landscape and architecture, mountains with trees on them or with buildings. They're really abstract.
Born in 1948, the artist has spent most of his life in Haymond, a former coal mining community in Letcher County. His artwork depicts landscapes, portraits, and scenes of daily life in rural Kentucky. Swain says at first they might appear to be simple scenes of Appalachia, but one needs to take a closer look to truly see the artist's intent.
You see a simple subject like someone hanging clothes on a washing line in a summer. The closer you get to it and the further you look into it, the more there is and the more that makes you wonder. There's a great deal of ambiguity that comes out of it as you spend time watching it.
One of the goals of the Kentucky Folk Art Center with this exhibition was to draw attention to David Lucas and present his artwork to a broader audience.
He was known in Kentucky, but not really exposed to the world outside. All but just a handful of those paintings have sold, which means that, yes, in a sense, we've succeeded in putting David on the map, drawing attention to it and getting it out into a number of different collections where people will talk about it and value it, continue looking at it over a period of years.
And Lucas's paintings capture life in eastern Kentucky, a snapshot of Appalachia. Swain believes his artwork is an important element to our culture and heritage.
I think in time they'll stand up as historic documents because they reflect, just like any artist's work, they reflect the artist's reaction to the world at the time in which they live. And you know, that can take many, many forms. David's work is looking at a part of life in Kentucky and the world. David looks at the world and I don't think his art particularly makes judgments, but it presents it as he sees it. So you see scenes of a world that has deteriorated, but you also see elements of life continuing with hope and pleasure in people's eyes as well in the present.
Adrian Swain, artistic director of the Kentucky Folk Art Center at Morehead State University. The center is located on First Street adjacent to the Morehead Conference Center. The exhibit will be on display through October 12th. Viewing hours are Mondays through Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and there is no charge for admission. Reporting for Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Paul Hitchcock.
A different kind of art is the center of attention in Danville, Kentucky this week. Bourbon barrels are on the auction block, not for their contents, but as art objects. The barrels are decorated and then sold during the state barbecue festival. As WEKU Stu Johnson reports, 33 barrels are entered in this weekend's fundraiser.
Decorating a bourbon barrel offers all kinds of thought-provoking opportunities for artists. Susan Hensley, who coordinates the bourbon barrel auction, says during their first event, lots of ideas were played out on 30 barrels.
Last year, Caterpillar did what we called the party wagon, which was a cooler on wheels made out of a barrel. And then we had one that was painted. It was called Go Picasso Horses, okay, with a Van Gogh. I mean, it is incredible.
There was also a barrel painted pink and given the legs, tail, and face of a pig. Every barrel's starting price is $250, but last year's winner of the Judge's Choice Award earned $2,500. The proceeds will again go to the Heart of Kentucky United Way. Hensley says the decorated barrels are used in various ways.
People have actually put them in their kitchens and use them as an extension of their island. We've had them that they have little benches, bar stools, and they use them like that.
Hensley says there's lots of energy behind this second bourbon barrel art project. She says some Danville residents are already talking about a third year.
I thought that we would probably have spent the energy, you know, on this one. But I've had several of my sponsors this year have said, oh, Susan, we know what we're going to do next year. And I'm thinking, oh, well, I wasn't really doing that.
If not barrels, Hensley believes some type of similar event would likely be a part of the next barbecue festival. For WEKU News, I'm Stu Johnson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Lexington's Mary Todd Lincoln House is reporting its highest attendance figures to date. More than 11,000 people visited the museum in the last fiscal year, higher than any amount since they started keeping records in 1982. Director Gwen Thompson says a variety of factors led to this increase.
I got to give a big kudos to the Lexington Convention and Visitors Bureau. Last fall, they moved to Main Street just a hop and a skip from us, and I think that their presence on Main Street as our neighbor has really, really helped with our attendance figures. We're right down the road from them. We have a good relationship with them, and we have a mutual respect, and they know that they can confidently tell visitors to come here and that they'll have a good experience.
Thompson says the Bureau helped bring in 20% of last year's visitors. She also credits the revitalization of downtown and Steven Spielberg's recent Lincoln biopic. Classic compositions are years in the making. Even after the score is written, there are revisions and performances. Even then, they must build reputations as great works. That can take decades if it happens at all. A new symphony performed later this month in Lexington has such potential, but as Kentucky Public Radio's Roger Duvall reports, its composer still has a long road to travel.
The life of modern composers is not easy. When it's performed, orchestras play that music alongside masterworks from composers like Beethoven or Haydn or Copland. That's because most audiences only want to hear the work of the great masters. Most likely, they'll patiently endure a new piece that took months, if not years, to perfect. It's an experience felt by composer Adam Schoenberg as he created his American Symphony.
The genesis of the work dates all the way back to November of 2008, right after President Obama was elected. And I should preface this by saying the American Symphony was never a political work. I was inspired to write the work after the election because at the same time I heard Aaron Copland's Third Symphony, which really is the quintessential American Symphony as far as I'm concerned. And Copland wrote his Third Symphony in 1946, 1 year after World War II, at a time when our country and, of course, our world was still in great turmoil. And granted, we weren't having a world war when Obama was elected, but I think it's safe to say that our country felt that we just needed change, no matter which president was elected. And, you know, for me, I also, at that stage in my life, just as an adult, it was really the first election in my lifetime that I felt very much a part of. And so I felt this civic duty to try to contribute to bringing more positive change to our country. And the best way I can do that is through my music. And so there was already a greater message that went beyond me just being a composer.
Since writing his American Symphony in 2009, Schoenberg has made some 300 revisions. Still, he insists, that's not an unusual number of changes.
Part of the beauty of writing a piece of music is it lives with you and you alone for such a long period of time. You know, sometimes a year, sometimes a year and a half. And then when you put the double bar down at the end, you have to relinquish control and let the musicians and the conductor bring it to life. So you have to let go. I mean, in terms of my obsessiveness, I just wanted to be satisfied with the new version because there's always moments in the piece that just didn't work for me. And as a young composer, you're always sort of fighting with yourself to perfect your craft. Because it just takes a long time to get better. You want to grow as a composer. So having this new performance gave me an opportunity to fix the piece. But this is the only work of mine I've ever revised. And believe me, I could go back and revise all of my works, but I've chosen not to. I think I would become incredibly obsessive at that point if I went back to all of my pieces.
Over the next year, Adam Schoenberg serves as the composer in residence for both the Lexington Philharmonic and the Chamber Music Festival of Lexington. And in 2 weeks, his American Symphony is performed at the Singletary Center by the Lexington Philharmonic. Its performance comes at the beginning of a national tour. The American Symphony Project will have Schoenberg's newly reworked piece performed in all 50 states. In addition to the exposure, Schoenberg hopes the tour's timing will also benefit the nation's troubled symphony orchestras.
After the piece was premiered, we started learning about orchestras going on strike. I mean, you look at now, there's so many orchestras that are just struggling. There's this financial crisis, and the art form, of course, is not dying whatsoever, but orchestras need to revamp themselves and sort of become a 21st century business model. And I felt with the American Symphony, it could be a way to try to unite all orchestras across the country to sort of come together and perform a piece that really does have a positive message. And also with the project being launched, it was a way for my publisher to reduce rental rates to make the piece more affordable because it's sometimes expensive to just perform a work. So this was a way to try to get the community to unite and perform a piece.
Management at the Lexington Philharmonic is familiar with the work of Adam Schoenberg. The composer and Philharmonic music director Scott Terrell are regulars at the Aspen Music Festival. As a result, the Lexington stop will be the first one on the American Symphony's two-year tour.
The Lexington Philharmonic was really one of the first orchestras to join, and that's a testament to just my relationship with Scott and Scott's commitment to bringing new music to the area, which is really fantastic.
As composer in residence, Schoenberg will return to Kentucky in spring and late summer 2014 to debut two new pieces, one for the Lexington Philharmonic and one for the Chamber Music Festival of Lexington. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Roger Duvall.
Adam Schoenberg's American Symphony is featured in the Lexington Philharmonic's upcoming season. The opening concert is Friday, September 20th. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Pettaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpubcast.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpubcast.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by the Augusta Heritage Center of Davis and Elkins College, presenting summer workshops in traditional music, dance, and crafts in Elkins, West Virginia. Details at augustaheritagecenter.org.